to me, it really is home to these wildlife species. And so I'm in their home and I'm in their house and I'm the guest. And, you know, I need to take off my shoes as appropriate and whatever that looks like. And so in the winter, for me, that kind of taking off of my shoes is maybe picking a different route or picking a different elevation.
Welcome back to the Voices of Greater Yellowstone podcast, where we share the stories and science of the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem. I'm your host, Kristen Oxford, but I am sad to report that this will be my last episode as host of the podcast. But don't worry, the podcast will go on and continue to cover interesting topics from this amazing region. So stay tuned for updates and exciting changes. Winter is a brutal time of year in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem. The sun rises late and sets early, temperatures stay well below freezing for weeks on end, and the snow can pile up foot on top of foot. For the ecosystem's many ungulates, including pronghorn, elk, deer, and moose, winter is the hardest season to survive. For the best chance of enduring the cold and snow, ungulates migrate with the seasons, seeking milder winter habitat that provides a respite from winter's intensity and a better chance of finding food. In this episode, we sit down with the Greater Yellowstone Coalition's Senior Idaho Conservation Associate, Allison Mikelski. Allison leads many of GYC's efforts in Idaho, including securing protections for winter range, advocating for travel management policies that include seasonal closures for winter habitat, and promoting habitat connectivity along Idaho's Highway 20 and Highway 33. In our conversation, we'll learn more about what makes winter wildlife habitat so important and what Allison and the Greater Yellowstone Coalition are doing to preserve seasonal habitat connectivity. Allison also has a little surprise in store at the end of the episode, so please stay tuned for that as well. All right, let's dive in with Allison Mikelski and learn more about winter wildlife habitat.
My name is Allison Mikelski, and my job title is Senior Idaho Conservation Associate.
Wonderful. Allison, so glad that you're here today. So you are based in our Driggs, Idaho office, and you live in Driggs. Can you tell us a little bit about what brought you to the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem?
So I first came out west. I grew up back east. And so I first came out west. I went on a ski trip to Colorado with my dad when I was a kid. And it was the first time I had seen big mountains and I fell completely in love. And I thought, oh my gosh, I can't believe people live like this, live in the mountains, live out here. It was incredible. And so I thought, whatever I have to do to get back out west when I have the chance is what I'm going to do. And so I graduated college. I worked for an outdoor leadership school, and as part of that work, I visited Grand Teton National Park, and I absolutely fell in love with the park and Jenny Lake and Jackson Lake. And I thought, this is exactly the spot that I have to come back to. And so after I finished graduate school with the sole goal of speaking for the trees as my career path, I was able to secure some internships in Montana and then in Idaho, and eventually find a home in Teton Valley.
Wonderful. I love that story, Lady Lorax. But you also went to law school in there too, kind of glossing over some important stuff there, Allison.
I did.
So you have a really unique background, and it's wonderful to know what brought you out to Idaho, but what drew you to conservation work?
Great question. So when I was a student at the Outdoor Leadership School, I had a transformative experience where I had really only previously experienced nature through organized sports. I hadn't done other activities like rock climbing or boating or much skiing. And so working at that leadership school really opened my eyes to this whole other culture and this whole world of recreation and all the different opportunities and ways that people get out in nature out west. So I knew I really wanted to work in nature. And so after I graduated from the leadership school, I got a job with the leadership school, which brought me to Arizona for a year. And while I was working there, the land management decisions that were happening for students and for courses that we ran on public lands were really impacting not only the natural resources, but also the students' experience on those public lands. And we did a whole lot of talking about land management, but we didn't do much about it. And so that ultimately inspired me to say, I think I might have the passion and the skills to actually do something about this. And I gave law school a shot.
That's awesome. So then what did you do after law school?
So after I graduated law school, I had an internship lined up in Teton Valley because I knew so deeply that I wanted to come back here. And I worked as a legal intern for a local nonprofit focused on watershed protection here in the Valley. And then ultimately that led me to connect with some really incredible Greater Yellowstone Coalition employees. And that brought me to my current position in Driggs as the Idaho Conservation Associate.
Awesome. Thanks, Allison. Just zooming out for a second, for folks who maybe don't live in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, can you situate us a little bit? So when you're talking about Teton Valley, most folks might be aware of Grand Teton National Park, but where's Teton Valley in relation to everything else kind of in Greater Yellowstone?
Great question. Teton Valley is kind of the locals' way of referring to the several cities on the west side of the Tetons, namely Victor, Idaho, Driggs, Idaho, and probably including Tetonia, Idaho as well. So collectively, these three small cities that border the western edge of the park that are located in Idaho are known as Teton Valley.
Perfect. Thanks for that. So you do so much work and work on so many different projects for the Greater Yellowstone Coalition. But the thing we're going to really focus in on today is your work protecting winter wildlife habitat for many of the truly iconic animals found here. So before we get into the specifics of winter habitat, could you just kind of give us a primer on how animals move around our region and why they might prefer, one kind of place to another, depending on the season?
Sure. So generally speaking, in my head, I like to think about two kind of groups of animals. We have resident animals, and then we have migratory animals. And so when I say resident animals, I'm referring to the individual wildlife that are not migratory and that tend to stay and occupy the same seasonal range all year round. They might move within a couple mile radius of that seasonal range, but really they typically stay in one area. For me, the migratory animals refer to animals that move maybe thousands of miles or 100 miles or even a shorter distance, maybe up a mountain or between a pond. And not all animals migrate, but for those that do, they do it for a variety of reasons. They try to find food, they try to avoid risky conditions, or they're competing for limited resources.
Okay, got it. Could you give us a couple examples of the different animals that fall into those different categories?
Sure. So some of the animals in Idaho that we see both resident kinds and also migratory populations of are elk, moose, mule deer, pronghorn.
Awesome. So some of our just like big iconic ungulates. So let's dig into winter habitat a bit then. So why is it that when we're talking about the importance of, protecting seasonal habitat, we're very often calling out winter habitat as being so important? Is there something about winter habitat that makes it, maybe more urgent to protect than summer, spring, fall habitat?
Good question. So I would say all habitat is very important, but winter habitat is especially important. And this is primarily due to the fact that surviving a winter in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem is really difficult, especially for migratory ungulates. Oftentimes in the winter, food resources can be depleted, and then climate conditions are so much more harsh. the food is less available, what's there is less nutritious. And then we have cold temperatures, snowy weather, lack of sunlight, oftentimes high winds, and other stressful conditions that really impact an animal's body condition and their overall health. In most cases, animals don't even get to eat as many calories in the winter. So oftentimes they're relying on things like fat stores and other reserves to make it through these harsh conditions.
Okay, awesome. So it just sounds like winter habitat's really important for survival. You know, if an animal can't access the resources it needs during our really harsh winters, that just potentially puts their ability to survive in this place at risk. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. Big game, many migratory birds and other wildlife, they often move to lower elevations in search of food resources that are available and to escape the deep snow, cold temperatures, and wind chills at higher elevations, which are often where their summer ranges are. One interesting note about this migratory pattern is that the act of moving itself even requires energy, which is often scarce in the winter. So this makes winter habitat even more important. So most wildlife populations contain a spectrum of behaviors between resident wildlife and migratory wildlife. For example, ecosystems like high elevation mountains in Idaho can produce excellent food in the summer months, but then the winter conditions in these environments are often so harsh, so inhospitable that the animals have to move somewhere else. Similarly, in low elevation areas, they can have relatively mild winter climates. And these areas are maybe less productive in the summer when increased temperatures dry out forage more quickly. But in the winter, they offer these super special reserves of food for animals that are really looking and trying hard to forage for whatever's available on the ground. So rather than staying in any one area, migration and movement between seasonally productive areas has basically been an evolutionary behavior that can increase things like fitness, ultimately survival, and then reproductive success.
Awesome. So I think we're kind of circling in on the answer to the next question I was going to ask you, which is, you know, just what are some characteristics of good winter habitat for animals like moose, elk, deer, pronghorn?
So often the characteristics of good winter habitat coincide with characteristics of lower elevation areas. So places where cold conditions are less harsh, sun is more readily available, and then they're replete with resources like food. And then they also provide opportunities for resources like cover and security. Cover refers to the tree canopy cover, and it impacts how much rain and sunlight can reach the ground. And it's also directly related to which species use and thrive in areas below trees. Security, on the other hand, is generally referring to any large and intact stand of forest that is away from roads, that has an adequate amount of forage and water nearby, and oftentimes offers a view of the landscape as well as any escape corridors. Security habitat is often where animals like elk will bed down to escape pressures from activities like hunting in the fall or even skiing in the winter.
Okay, so let's dig into winter habitat specifically. Why is it that we call out winter habitat as being important to protect? You know, is there something about winter habitat that makes it more urgent to protect than summer, spring, or fall habitat?
Sure is. And I would say it's something about winter in the GYE that really makes winter habitat so important to the GYE's wildlife. Winters in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem are so difficult to survive. They are extremely cold. They are incredibly snowy. They are very windy, and they are incredibly long. And so all of these factors put a lot of stress on the animals at a time when food is scarce, at a time when fat reserves are being depleted, and these animals need a safe place to essentially ride out this season of food scarcity and really harsh weather conditions. Lower elevations often offer the best opportunities for food resources, escape from deep snow, relief from cold temperatures, and respite from wind chill than the higher elevation summer ranges do. And so that's why these lower elevation winter habitats are so important.
Okay, awesome. Thank you for that description. So then where are some of these important ungulate winter habitats located in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem?
Winter ranges are often located at lower elevations, and I'll give you two examples from here in southeastern Idaho that I think are great examples of lower elevation winter ranges that provide really important habitat for ungulates. The first is the Tex Creek Wildlife Management Area. It's a mixture of state and federal lands, and it's managed by the Idaho Department of Fish and Game for wildlife. The Tex Creek Wildlife Management Area provides high quality and secure habitat for mule deer, for elk, and for moose that sometimes migrate to the wildlife management area from up to 70 miles away. It also supports a wide range of wildlife year-round. But primarily, it provides this really important habitat during the winter. The second example is the Sand Creek Wildlife Management Area. The Sand Creek Wildlife Management Area was initially created to help a small herd of elk that had wandered onto a private property for the winter. Hmm. Over time, the Idaho Department of Fish and Game purchased a parcel and purchased additional parcels and entered into agreements with federal and state land management agencies to manage a total of over 32,000 acres for the purposes of providing winter refuge for migratory deer, elk, and moose. And these deer, elk, and moose are coming from surrounding high elevation public lands like Grand Teton and Yellowstone National Park. Use varies from year to year on the Sand Creek Wildlife Management Area, but Idaho Department of Fish and Game estimates that approximately 2,500 mule deer, 3,500 elk, and about 500 moose winter across the greater Sand Creek Desert area every year.
Awesome. So winter habitat is clearly really important for the ability of these species to survive, but it can also be hard for them to reach. So what are some of the factors that might make it hard for ungulates to actually reach their winter range?
Such a fascinating question. A recent report from Pew and the Wyoming Migration Initiative identified human activity as the biggest threat to migratory behavior for wildlife. And when they say human activity, they mean things like fencing, roadways, residential developments, energy and mineral production operations. All of these things can block, alter, or fragment migration routes and limit access to adjacent habitat that migrating wildlife rely on. Climate change is also a factor that's altering things like growth patterns, abundance of forage, and timing and availability of forage.
Okay, so the animals in our ecosystem are up against kind of a lot. So what are some of the things that we can do to reduce those barriers? So obviously, there are a lot of roads cutting through habitat in this ecosystem. There's infrastructure everywhere. Humans share this landscape too. But how can we actually start working at reducing those barriers so that these animals can access winter habitat?
The good news is that even though the barriers are big, there's so much that we can do to reduce them. Some of the tools in our toolkit for reducing barriers include increasing mapping and researching efforts. Recently, the Ungulate Migrations of the Western United States, Volumes 1, 2, and 3 were released, and these have been tremendous resources for folks like myself who never had the opportunity to actually see the migratory path of certain herds before. And it just provides tremendous opportunities to then protect those migratory corridors. We also have tools in our toolkit, like removing or modifying fences in key migration corridors and replacing them with wildlife-friendly fencing alternatives. We can also build wildlife crossing structures along roads and highways that help wildlife move and migrate in and through corridors. We can engage in local land use planning efforts. We can provide conservation easements or other incentives to landowners. And we can practice smart energy and mineral development on federal and other public lands.
So can you think of some examples where seasonal habitat connectivity has been, you know, either preserved or successfully restored thanks to efforts like the ones that you've just mentioned?
I can. One story always comes to mind when I think about migrating wildlife, and that's the story of Rocky Point Project, which is a project that Greater Yellowstone worked on several years ago in collaboration with the Idaho Department of Fish and Game and several other organizations. So what GYC did was work with Idaho Department of Fish and Game to secure two voluntary conservation easements, which are tools in the toolkit that we mentioned before, at this place called Rocky Point, which is south of Montpelier, Idaho, in Bear Lake County. And those easements will permanently protect crucial migration areas for big game on more than 1,800 acres in southeastern Idaho. The conservation easements for the property on both sides of the highway offer opportunities for thousands of mule deer to cross the highway on their migration between summer range in the Caribou Mountains and winter range on the Bear Lake Plateau. Based on the terms of the conservation easements, the properties will remain undeveloped to ensure that the land remains a big game migration area and that access to winter range is permanently protected. This also combines another tool in the toolkit. And so it's not just about conservation easements here. It's also about how we can pair tools together. And so this is an area where we paired conservation easements with also the opportunity to identify wildlife crossing opportunities. So based on collision reports and staff observations, remote cameras, and electronic collar data, there was a ton of information that showed that the mule deer that are migrating across this highway are really only migrating across a 3 or 4 mile stretch of the highway that borders these easements. And so the conservation easements open the door for solutions that could decrease the number of wildlife vehicle collisions moving forward, which is what the people of Bear Lake County really wanted. And so Idaho Department of Fish and Game and Idaho Transportation Department are now working together to design wildlife crossing improvements for this segment of Highway 30.
Awesome. Thanks for that, Allison. And bonus points to you for also including an example that GYC actually worked on. So can you tell us a bit about your work to help protect crucial winter habitat on Bureau of Land Management lands in Idaho?
Sure. My work for protecting winter range on Bureau of Land Management lands revolves around the travel management planning process. The Upper Snake Field Office, which encompasses much of the Sand Creek Desert area, is currently in the process of looking at critical routes and trails on Bureau of Land Management lands in the Upper Snake East Travel Management Planning Area through the travel management planning process, which is really the first time Bureau of Land Management has ever done travel management planning in this specific area. Travel management planning offers us an opportunity to take a thoughtful and more organized look at how people and recreationists are traveling through this planning area and using the trails and other resources, and also to consider and evaluate how we manage motorized and non-motorized routes on these lands. The travel management plan is really an opportunity to protect wildlife habitat, and in this case, specifically winter wildlife habitat, and preserve high quality recreation opportunities in this area. We anticipate that Bureau of Land Management will issue a final travel management plan for the Upper Snake East Travel Management Planning Area this spring. So we're eagerly awaiting that plan, and we'll be looking for opportunities to protect winter range and winter habitat specifically in that travel plan.
Okay, so I'm trying to make sure that I understand this. There's a BLM planning process that looks at how people move across the landscape and also how animals use that landscape. And in your role at GYC, you know, once that process is announced, you'll be, I would assume, providing recommendations and just trying to balance those things so that we ensure positive outcomes for the wildlife in that area.
Yeah, so we were fortunate enough to have this process kick off last year. And so we had a draft travel management plan, which looked at several different alternatives for this specific planning area. And there was one alternative that was most protective of these critical winter range areas. And so Greater Yellowstone Coalition and our partners are not only issuing comments and working to elevate and support the prioritization and protection of those habitats, but also to get the general public involved and understand, you know, where are these lands? Where are these animals spending the winter? How are they doing it? And then maybe even, how can I help protect them, whether that's through my own actions or through submitting a comment to BLM through this travel management planning process?
Awesome. So yeah, speaking of the public and recreators, you know, what are some things that sort of just the average individual could do to help protect winter wildlife habitat? So you just mentioned submitting comments and things like travel management planning. Is there anything else that folks can do just to make sure that they're behaving in a way that's protective of animals being able to access winter ranges?
Absolutely. And our friends at Winter Wildlife Alliance have this really great short list that I love to use. It's three easy tips for traveling and moving in the winter in a way that is mindful and also protective of our wintering wildlife and the habitats they need. So one is know before you go. When you're planning trips and activities, look up local wildlife habitat area boundaries and consider the conditions. Are there closures in place? Are there warnings? Can you avoid traveling through winter range? And will animals likely be in survival mode at that time of year? So, you know, if it's a big stormy day and you're out skiing in the backcountry and you see a bighorn sheep just down the way, can you take a different route? It's just a really interesting thought and a different way to travel, but I think it has a lot of merit. Two, go to plan B. If you see a herd of animals or fresh tracks, you can always turn around. Consider plans B and C or even D. And then if you encounter wildlife, give them space. Be patient. Move slowly. Definitely, if you have animals with you, please don't let your dogs chase the wildlife. If wildlife are at lower elevations, maybe you can go to higher elevations. And if you see other people on the trail who might encounter the same wildlife, maybe give them a heads up. Three, green up is not a green light. And this is a great thing, I think, as we are all eagerly awaiting the spring months and the greener weather. Green up is the term that Winter Wildlands Alliance uses to refer to the time when green vegetation finally reemerges after a long winter. And that means more food for wildlife. So wildlife are trying to bulk up and recover in these spring months after being at the very end of their energy reserves. And they're not out of the woods yet. So be cautious and, you know, maybe yellow light, green up, yellow light. And the last one I would add that's not on their list is be proactive. There's so many opportunities for you to advocate for your local wildlife, for your local winter habitats, whether that's travel management planning in your area, a forest plan revision, or even just looking at something smaller, a different tool like a winter closure, and let the land managers know what you're seeing on the ground and how you think that there are opportunities to do better and provide more protection to the wildlife, especially if you see them struggling in these difficult months.
Oh, thanks for that, Allison. I really love that insight and those suggestions because it's such a good reminder that, you know, even though we should always be as respectful as possible of our wild neighbors when we're out recreating, that just being mindful that in the winter time, there
already pretty stressed and they're already trying really hard to survive, and just give them extra space and, you know, be as thoughtful as you can. Like, that's certainly a really good reminder. So thanks for sharing those.
Yeah, you're welcome. And I always like to think, you know, when I'm in the backcountry, even though that feels like home to me, it really is home to these wildlife species. And so I'm in their home and I'm in their house and I'm the guest. And, you know, I need to take off my shoes as appropriate and whatever that looks like. And so in the winter, for me, that kind of taking off of my shoes is maybe picking a different route or picking a different elevation or, you know, letting someone know what I saw on the trail earlier that day.
Oh, Allison, thanks for sharing that. I think those are, again, just really wonderful reminders of what it's like to, you know, move with some respect across this landscape. You know, earlier when we were talking about what first brought you out to the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, you mentioned part of that journey kind of including learning new ways to recreate and enjoy the outdoors. Can you just tell us a little bit about how you spend your time when you're not working and what are some of the ways that you enjoy the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem these days?
Yeah, my pleasure. So I guess like wildlife, I've developed a bit of a seasonality about my recreation. And so it's kind of like, what's the weather doing and what's the season? And that's how I pick how I'm going to be outside that day. And let's start now with winter. So I love to ski. So I ski in the backcountry. I ski at the resort. I also love cross-country skiing in the woods, and I recently learned and am still learning how to properly skate ski, but that has been a fun adventure. And then come springtime, I'll start trail running again. That's really a big passion of mine and something that I've taken a deep dive into over the past couple years, and it's a way for me to get really deep into the ecosystem and, you know, literally have my feet in the dirt, and I just love it. And so I trail run and I hike and I climb in the summertime and the spring months when the weather is a little better. And on my rest days, I love to get out on the river or the lake. And so whether that's paddling or surfing or, like I said, you know, whatever the weather and the season and maybe even an opportunity is of the day is how I'll pick that activity.
I love that. So you too have seasonal habitat that you enjoy.
I sure do have seasonal habitat.
That's wonderful. Allison, it's been so lovely to talk to you today. I am so grateful that you are out there doing the incredible work that you are doing to help protect the species of this ecosystem. I just want to ask you the sort of standard stalwart question that we ask everybody on the podcast, which is, who is your conservation hero?
Well, Kristen, I thought a lot about this one, especially being with you today. And so I would like to offer Mary Oliver as my conservation hero. I think Mary Oliver is a conservation hero because she brings attention to nature and highlights the special connection that humanity has with nature, whatever that means for you. She is a nature storyteller. And the power of story is what really, I believe, connects us to nature. It's also what moves and motivates us to action. And so Mary Oliver was all about nature and action. And I think she has inspired me over and over again to slow down, to observe, and to connect with the natural world. And so, Kristen, I just want to offer a Mary Oliver poem, if I may.
Yes, yes, yes. I love this answer. I think you were the first person who has chosen a poet as their conservation hero, but Mary Oliver absolutely deserves that place as someone who has encouraged so many people to look at the natural world in a new way. And if you would share a poem with us, I would be absolutely delighted.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so I'm going to offer this reading of Mary Oliver's Imagination to you, really. You know, I know we share a love of poetry, and it's been such a joy of mine over the years to get to trade books with you and poems and thoughts. And so I wanted to offer this to you and thanks.
Thank you, Allison.
So this is Imagination by Mary Oliver. Oh, do you have time to linger for just a little while out of your busy and very important day for the goldfinches that have gathered in a field of thistles for a musical battle to see who can sing the highest note or the lowest or the most expressive of mirth or the most tender? Their strong, blunt beaks drink the air as they strive melodiously, not for your sake and not for mine, and not for the sake of winning, but for sheer delight and gratitude. Believe us, they say, it is a serious thing just to be alive on this fresh morning in the broken world. I beg of you, do not walk by without pausing to attend this rather ridiculous performance. It could mean something. It could mean everything. It could be what Rilke meant when he wrote, "You must change your life."
Allison, that was beautiful and perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Well, friends, I wish we could end all podcast episodes with a poem from Mary Oliver. We're so grateful Allison was able to join us on the podcast and share her work on and knowledge of preserving winter wildlife habitat in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem. It's important work, and we're lucky that Allison is on it. If you live in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem or plan on recreating in it this winter and spring, please plan on checking those winter closures, adjust your plans to accommodate wildlife, and keep dogs on leash or close by. When we all do our part, we can allow our ungulate friends and other wildlife to survive and thrive year-round. The Voices of Greater Yellowstone is a podcast by the Greater Yellowstone Coalition, a conservation nonprofit that works with all people to protect the lands, waters, and wildlife of the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem. Please consider supporting the podcast with a gift to GYC or by sharing this episode with a friend. Well, folks, it's been a pleasure. And while I will miss being your host, I look forward to joining the ranks of devoted listeners moving forward. And who knows, maybe my name will even pop up in listener questions sometime soon. Thanks for stopping by, and we'll see you next time.